who plays the best piano by far. He can play piano any way that you like it, but the way he likes to play is A to the bar. When he plays, it's a ball, he's the daddy of them all. The people gather around when he gets on the stand, and when he plays, he gets a hand. The rhythm he beats puts the cats in a trance. Nobody there bothers to dance, but when he plays with the bass and guitar, they holler, oh, beat me, daddy, A to the bar. A blink, a flank, a blink, flank, blink, flank, a flunking on the key. A riff, a rap, a riff, rap, riff, rap, a riffin' out with thee. And when he plays with the bass and guitar, they holler, oh, beat me, daddy, A to the bar. Plays a boogie, he plays A to the bar, the boogie woogie. That is the way he likes to play on his piano. And we all know that when he plays, he puts them all in a trance. The cats all holler, hooray. You'll hear them say, beat me, daddy, A to the bar. Texas, there's a guy who plays the best piano by far. When he plays with the bass and guitar, they holler, beat me, oh daddy, beat me, daddy, A to the bar. The people gather around when he gets up on the stand, and when he plays, he gets a hand. The rhythm that he plays puts the cats in a trance. Nobody there ever bothers to dance, but when he plays with the bass and guitar, they holler, oh, beat me, daddy, A to the bar. A blink, blink, a blink, blink, a blink, blank, blink, blank, a plunkin' on the key. A riff, riff, a rap, rap, a riff, rap, riff, rap, a riffin' out with these. But when he plays with the bass and guitar, they holler, oh, beat me, daddy, A to the bar.
This is WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, Local News and Alternative Views. And we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. Hello and welcome to our show today. It is March. Yeah, March the 5th. Yeah, and my name is Jay Koronick. I'm joined in the studio by our WHFR News Director, Dennis Reimars. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, how are you?
Well, how's that scholarship feeling, Dennis?
Wow. It feels good. We had an opportunity. Jay, you're talking about the three of us, along with some other people from the station, went to Lansing on Wednesday. And we had an opportunity to share in some festivities, a lot of learning, and I did end up the recipient of a scholarship.
Yeah, actually, it was a professional broadcasting conference held by the Michigan Association of Broadcasters, and Dennis did receive the Charles D., I think it is, Fritz scholarship. Mr. Fritz was longtime owner, runner, manager, whatever, of WXYZ TV.
Owner, yes.
Owner, right. And his son was there actually at the table with you, and you were talking to him, and I assume thanking him profusely for this honor. And we're very proud of you, Dennis, and all the other winners of MAB Student and College Awards, as well as other scholarship winners, too. It's an organization that is primarily the commercial radio and TV broadcasters of Michigan, but we're a member, too, along with the public broadcasting stations funded by the federal government, radio and TV. And it was a great experience, and I just wanted to commend you, Dennis, on that scholarship. And what do they say about clothes? Please wear it well. Take some great classes and learn a lot next year. And it's not exactly a free ride, folks, but it's a great chunk of change that helps people, a variety of people all around the state. I don't know, it must have been a dozen or more scholarships of one sort or another that were awarded on Wednesday in Lansing for high schoolers coming to college as well as people continuing in college. Okay, well, that's Dennis and Amy, who is our WHFR news reporter. I think your microphone's not on, but go ahead, Amy.
I'm going to say congratulations, Dennis. That's well-deserved.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, Amy.
On the show today, we're going to cover, of course, Dearborn and surrounding area highlights and news and things that other stations won't do, since we're the station making waves, after all. We're the local news, really, of this area, at least the local broadcast news. And, Amy, we hope to have a special guest calling in. Tell us about that person.
Well, as people may have heard earlier today, Detroit was left out of the Race to the Top education funding. We have the Director of Communications, Martin Ackley, calling in for Superintendent Mike Flanagan. So hope to get a few answers on how Michigan was left out of this.
Or Detroit specifically?
Detroit specifically.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and this I didn't hear that late-breaking news, but Amy was on top of it this morning, and it's just ironic because of the story we covered several months ago in terms of national testing. Detroit Public Schools comes out at the bottom of major urban areas around the country in terms of what they're achieving, apparently, how they're getting across the basics of, at least, I think it was a math test especially that they looked at, but the worst, can you get that, folks? The worst in the U.S. In terms of achievement levels. So I don't know what can be done, but one would think that the Race to the Top funding, which comes from the federal government, you had to make applications. They didn't have money for everybody, which is too bad. Of all the things government should have money for, it's, well, I think healthcare first and education second, but a close second. Nonetheless, that's what I want my government to do, folks, not fight foreign wars where there's no direct connection to our safety. Nonetheless, by the way, if we didn't mention already, let's get it out of the way, that on today's show, the opinions expressed here on this show are not necessarily those of anyone at Henry Ford Community College. They didn't tell us what to say, and they're not responsible, but we do thank them for the chance to challenge you. Don't believe what we say. We're not pundits here. We're just challenging you to think and research and look into these issues yourselves. You got to make that decision on these important issues yourselves and then figure out what to do. There's a lot to do, and we can change things if we know what's happening and if we get a lot of points of view and then we make good decisions. So I assume the director of communications for the superintendent's office should have a lot to say. I mean, that's in the job description, I think, right?
That it is.
And I want to find out, too, especially about how responsible are they for funding. I bet they put together the final touches on that application, though.
And
State to the federal government.
Right. And interested in how much input the MEA has in that application and advising their members on which way they would like them to. Okay.
And the MEA is?
Michigan Education Association.
Right. It's the largest organization, a union, in fact, representing teachers primarily at K-12. I think it's only at K-12.
Okay.
There's, of course, the union that that Dearborn teachers are part of, and even Henry Ford Community College teachers in a different chapter, and that is the American Federation of Teachers. So we don't know what position they take. I assume both of them were supportive of these applications.
Well, no. They the MEA was staunchly opposed to it.
Some of the reforms they felt were too radical or inappropriate.
Inappropriate, that they hadn't been made fully aware of all the the points within the documents that would be sent in with the application. I guess those were not going to be made available until after they made application, so they wouldn't sign on.
Right. We're going to try to see if there was any explanation why Michigan or at least Detroit wasn't funded. I mean, I think we need to delineate that at least, whether it was Detroit or whether any money trickled in somewhere else in the state. And if they gave any explanation, it's like if you apply for a job and you don't get hired, you'd like to know what was it, how, in what ways was my resume or my attitude, I don't know, whatever I was deficient so that I can improve. And and if I need more education, tell me that so I can go out and sign up for some classes or whatever. I mean, you'd like to know exactly why you didn't qualify in for whatever you're going
into. And how you can improve for the next round.
Yeah, and I'm not sure the government tells anybody about that, even though you'd think they should. Well, okay, so let's take a look at some other issues here. We're just about 5 or 6 minutes away from expecting that call from, again, the director.
Martin Ackley,
yep, director of communications for the State Superintendent of Public Instruction, State Board of Ed, I call it, but it's the State Board of Public Instruction. And I guess education is not the issue. Instruction is only the issue. That's really bad. You know, actually, think of the meaning of the terms. Education is so totally holistic, inside out, growth, development, and instruction. That's just teaching. You don't care about the consequences. I mean, they shouldn't have changed the name if they did. I'll keep calling them State Board of Ed because I'd like to think about the whole growth of a person. But, of course, that's kind of mystical. And
well, that's what do you fine expect? Distinction.
Yeah, what do you expect teachers to do about that? I mean, give them the test and teach them some stuff. Give them the test, and it's up to them after that. All right. I was at the center this week for a meeting on another important issue. We're going to talk about the State of the City address today, which is coming up next Wednesday. And I want to say, very proud of this, WHFR has the exclusive live broadcast rights on that. We're right here. Dennis, myself, probably Amy, too, will be on the team, and we'll be presenting live from the center, that is the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center on Michigan Avenue, the State of the City address from Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr. right here in Dearborn. So that's next Wednesday. It'll broadcast. We'll start, and we'll give some background about 6:45. The speech is expected to start at 7:00. And maybe half an hour, maybe an hour. It all depends on how much the mayor wants to go into details and introduce sort of ad lib, as he often does, as Mayor Guido often did, people in the audience. It is a free, it's free to attend. There's about 1,200 seats there, folks. If you want to go over to the center, you don't have to RSVP. You can just show up about 6:30 when they start opening the doors and get a good seat. Of course, elected representatives, judges, council members, and all that are down front. Media next. That's us. No, we're actually going to be backstage. We may have a reporter or two from WHFR in the media section. We won't have much of a chance to interview folks, either before or after. It's a celebratory thing. It's an informational thing. We're going to get the details from Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr. Directly from him right here on Friday, April the 16th. During our Pledge Drive Week, as we call it, WHFR Radiothon 2010. And Mayor O'Reilly, as he has done the last couple of years, comes in. He does a request for funds for us, which is sweet of him. And we'll get some details on some of the points that people might be talking about still, just a month away, actually. So State of the City address, excuse me, is next Wednesday, March 13th, and Mayor O'Reilly here on WHFR Journal for, we hope, the whole hour, unless he has an important meeting that'll break that up a little bit, on Friday, April the 16th. Okay, well, he suggested last week that for the additional budget cuts that are going to have to come in next year's budget, he said we should think outside of the box for financial survival. That's in the Dearborn Press and Guide Sunday, last week, Sunday, February 28th. He suggested, you know, not exactly privatizing, but outside operators for the center and for the, I think, the skating arena, too. And this week in the Press and Guide, if you want to check on it from Wednesday, March 3rd, right on the front page, the Dearborn City Council had to chime in. Dearborn City Council members see budget cuts but want to provide input. Well, of course, that's their function, and I'm sure we can't keep them quiet. Ultimately, the budget is drawn up initially by the mayor's office and with his elected and appointed administrative aides from the different departments, and then it does go to council for discussion and voting up or down. So they'll have their chance, but they wanted to seem like, well, it's not just the mayor making that decision. And, of course, it won't be, but none of these things have been decided yet. My mention at the beginning of my visit to the center to help planning the State of the City address, people around the table from various departments of the city were worried for their jobs, actually. If somebody else operates it, then maybe one of the things they'll do to save cost of operation and to make a profit for the operators more will be to fire some people. So some of them that just work there directly at the center kind of worried. They were quite scared, in fact, I thought, many of them over there. But I think everybody is kind of worried about their jobs and their security these days. It is not a good time. I did see in the paper today that the rate of joblessness has not gone up this month nationally. Although, I don't know about Michigan. we're always at the highest rate, not at the average rate of 9.7. We're usually around 15% in the last couple of months. When they talk about the rate of joblessness, that can be different. I'm going to pick up the phone here right on the air.
And I would believe that would be
Hi, this is
Martin Ackley, Director of Communications for the Superintendent.
We certainly hope so.
Michael Flanagan. We talked about Michael Flanagan last week.
Hi, Martin.
Week,
my name is Jake Koronek. I'm the host for the show.
The school funding.
Amy Powers, who
so
talked to you.
It'll be nice
this,
to get a few answers on the race to the top
is
funding.
Right here, and I'm going to patch you into the console, and we'll get started right away. About 10 minutes of your time. Is that possible?
I think you can hear Jay in the background discussing the interview.
Here it comes.
I'll say welcome Martin Ackley, Director of Communications for the Office of Michigan, the State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Thank you for being on WHFR, the Journal, today.
Oh, you're more than welcome, Amy and Jay.
Thank you.
By also the way, with us, is Dennis Reimers, our News Director.
Okay.
So, hi. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Good. It's a bit of a roundtable, so you might be getting questions from any one of the three of us. But if it's all right, I'll start out asking you briefly to tell our listeners what the Race to the Top education funding is.
Well, Race to the Top is a piece of the President Obama's stimulus package from last year. And what they did was they set apart $4.3 billion for states to apply for, to really push for reforms in education at the state and local level. So that's what the money is for, and that's what I think there are 40 states who did actually make application for these grants. And Michigan, we made application, we put our proposal in, yesterday U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan announced the states that were finalists, and there were 16 states who were finalists who go to the next round in order to get funding in the first round of grants. And Michigan was not included in that first cut, so that's where we sit now.
So you may have answered this. It's the state of Michigan rather than just the city of Detroit that wasn't included in that first round of finalists?
Correct. The states made application. Detroit was a component of our state application, in that included in our application was what is an initiative we have here in the Department of Education that State Superintendent Mike Flanagan began last year called Project Reimagine, which was his call to local school districts to come up with systemic district-wide reform proposals to really change the way that students are taught in Michigan. And Detroit was one of the 14 Project Reimagine districts, demonstration districts, we call them, and they were a key component of our Race to the Top application. So the city, or Detroit Public Schools, was a key element in our state plan. It wasn't the whole plan, but it was a key part.
So when Arne Duncan, the education secretary, openly calls Detroit schools a national disgrace, how does he justify Michigan not being part of the Race to the Top education funding?
Yeah, that's a good question for Secretary Duncan. We knew that Detroit was on the front of his radar screen, and we thought that would that would carry some weight with our application, and obviously it didn't. Each state's application, their proposal was given to national reviewers, and they scored the state's applications, and then they sent those to Secretary Duncan, and he made his decision from there. So we're anxious to see feedback from our application when it got scored to see where they saw that it was in need of some improvement. So,
when will you see those scores?
Well, the Secretary said yesterday, Secretary Duncan said yesterday that the winners will be announced in April, and that at that point, all of the state's applications will be released publicly so that every state will see what the winning states had. So the idea, I think, is for the President and for the Secretary Duncan, they want to have national systemic reforms in education. So what they're using this Race to the Top money for is to kind of prompt and provide a carrot for states to really push this. And I think what they want to do this first round is to highlight a couple of states that are really making dramatic changes in how they educate their kids, and they want to use that as a template for all the other states to replicate and then get Race to the Top funds. So there is a second round that all the states can apply for, and we here in Michigan certainly intend to apply again in June for the second round of the Race to the Top funds, and those would be awarded in September.
And is that funding the same amount, or is it decreased according to where you fall in the ranking?
Well, they have $4.35 billion in this entire pot of Race to the Top money, and they will spend it. They will spend a portion of it in this first round. And of the 16 finalists, states and the District of Columbia, of those 16. Only a small handful will actually get a grant this first time around. So there will be, I would guess, maybe two-thirds of that $4.35 billion pot remaining for the second round.
Okay. How pivotal do you think the support of the MEA, or support or lack of, was to Michigan's application for this funding?
We won't know that until we get back the our response, our feedback from our application from the U.S. Department of Education. We would have loved to have had their buy-in. I mean, they were included in all of the discussions and all of the processes as we were developing our application, and in the end, they chose not to. The AFT, the American Federation of Teachers Michigan, with David Hecker as their president, they supported our application at the end, and we appreciate that tremendously. But the MEA chose not to, and they notified all of their local presidents not to sign on to the memorandum of understanding for each school district. Although we did get over 90% of the school districts supporting our application, and about 50 of those actually got sign-ons from their local MEA presidents. So some did, and we know that, you know, anecdotally, a lot of the teachers in the classrooms across the state support these reforms.
We're talking with Martin Ackley here on the new WHFR Journal today. Martin is the Director of Communications for the State Superintendent of Public Instruction, who is Mike Flanagan. So you're in Mike Flanagan's office there. I wanted to ask Martin about the consequences of the reforms. It seems to me that the districts that supported and helped support this application for Race to the Top from the state, like Dearborn, the Board of Ed down here did vote that they would make these reforms as requested by Race to the Top happen, and the state legislature endorsed the application, of course, which means it endorsed the reform. Were these reforms that were talked about that the AFT supported and the MEA didn't contingent on funding? Will they happen without the funding?
Yeah, those reforms, there was a package of legislation that passed at the end of the last calendar year that the Governor Granholm, signed into law in January, the beginning of January,
right,
to make all these education reforms. Now, these reforms were needed and are necessary regardless of whether we got Race to the Top.
Okay.
And so these are in state law now. That doesn't change. these laws still have to be implemented.
Give our listeners just maybe two or three examples of these reforms, just to remind them.
Well, I think the biggest one is an effort to address the lowest 5% of our struggling schools in Michigan, is to identify them, provide them an opportunity to come up with a strategy to turn those, to turn around those struggling schools. Either in a very various ways that you can turn it into a charter school, you could close a school, you could change the administration of the school, you could bring in an outside consultant to change the way that kids are taught and how things are done in the schools. And so once those schools are identified, then we will provide them an opportunity, the school districts, to provide an opportunity to come up with their own plan. Mm-hmm. And if they can't come up with a plan, or they just don't want to come up with a plan, then the eventual consequence is that the state would take that school building over.
Okay.
And so that's a big point. There are other parts of it. There, yeah. We're going to the state law now creates two cyber schools. Mm-hmm. State law now increases the number of high quality charter schools. They increase the number of charter schools in the state. What it does, the reforms also allows for alternative certification for teachers to try to get minorities and teachers like laid off engineers from mm-hmm. Ford or GM to get them in the classrooms without having to go through the full 4-year teacher programs at the universities. What it does is it's an accelerated alternative pathway into the classroom as a teacher.
Right, because of their life experience and previous job experience.
Right, and it'll also increase the dropout age from 16 to 18. That was a big part of it, of the reform package, too. So, all these reforms needed to happen, regardless of race to the top. That was an encouragement, but we needed these, and we still have to implement
them. So when do they take effect?
They take effect immediately. In the Department of Education, we are starting to develop the systems and structures here to implement them.
And the new high school graduation requirements that have been approved a couple years ago, they're going into effect for graduates in 2011, or they start affecting high schools in 2011?
No, the graduating class of 2011.
Graduating class has to have those new requirements.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
There may be another question from Dennis or Amy here. We're going to let you go in just a couple minutes. We know how busy you are, and it is a Friday after all.
Beautiful Friday. Gorgeous weather.
You're in Lansing?
Yeah.
Are there any legislators left up there on Fridays? We understand they usually have that day off.
They're not in sessions,
no.
But I do know
yeah.
that some legislators stay here and
well,
work.
Well, thank you for being on the job anyway.
Sure.
I wanted to ask about just whether or not you or Mike Flanagan, what do you think, opinions here about nationally, apparently there's been suggestions, and apparently 12 states are trying the option of letting very qualified people based on testing at the 10th grade level to go immediately to a community college. And if they don't pass the test, then they're going to have to do 11th grade. And if they don't pass that, they're going to go to 12th grade. Representative in the state of Utah, I believe, suggested we don't even need senior year anymore. And then he got so many emails and such bad press, he backed off on that. Although I remember my senior year, nothing happened except activities and field trips and senior skip day. I don't think they have those anymore, but I graduated a long time ago.
Oh, they do.
People say they do. Okay.
Yeah.
Is it just any opinion on that development? I mean, Michigan hadn't even considered that, but... I guess it's worthy to look at the experiments to see how they come out.
Yeah, I think it's really up to the individual students. I mean, some students are ready after 10th grade to move on.
Mm-hmm.
Some students actually, need the full 12 years through 12th grade. We've had in Michigan for a number of years something called Early Middle Colleges, which is a program that that coordinates with the high school and a community college, so that by the end of that program in the I think it's a 5 or 6 year program, a student graduates from high school, but then also gets, an associate's degree from college.
Mm.
And so it's been pretty successful. So we are already implementing a similar circumstance here in Michigan with these early colleges. But if a student is ready to move on at the end of 10th grade, if they have the knowledge and the intellect and can show that, then why keep them in high school for another 2 years? Let them move on and and proceed with their education.
I will say that the highlight of my senior year, and this is back in 1964, so it's not exactly current history, but was that they did allow us, I went to Little Flat Rock High School at the southern edge of Wayne County here, and they actually had a program, thanks to one teacher, where a teacher from Eastern Michigan University came in and taught first semester English composition. And it was the highlight of my whole year. It was so challenging. It was like real, you know, studying and real credit, too. And, of course, here in Dearborn, you may or may not know that, you know, our Board of Ed are the same people that function as the Board of Trustees for Henry Ford Community College, as well as the Board of Ed. And so we certainly allow option for high school students in Dearborn to come on over here if they're ready, if their principal approves, their counselor, to take classes and sort of get a head start. And certainly you might say, well, they're avoiding all those 2011 graduation requirements. In a way, they're not, because college, certainly community college here, we got all those requirements in place, and they have to be tested and get into English and math and science, and and you know, we've got heavy duty regulations on what they need to take, and of course then they can explore other options. So
and they have advanced placement programs where students can take college credit. There are dual enrollment programs where kids can be both enrolled in both the high school and the community college or 4-year. So, you know, this idea has been around a while, but, you know, I think it'd be important to look at, you know, letting kids move on and then taking the money that would have been spent on those kids in the last 2 years or the last year in high school and put that on the other end. You know, invest that into early childhood education, because that's where you get the biggest bang for the buck, is in early childhood.
Yeah, I was sad to see that very special component of the Dearborn Schools, they ran a Montessori program from 2.5 to 5 years old here right in Dearborn, in the Dearborn Schools. And I think there was an extra fee, but nonetheless, maybe there wasn't, I don't know. But my daughter went through Montessori years ago, and that was a great head start on the typical, you know, kindergarten, first grade age. To get people ready, we got to keep them in school. We got to, you know, and maybe having the law say they got to stay to 18 will help. I know Detroit has it's fantastically terrible dropout rate.
Right.
Do you think one of the things, we'll go back to the point that we started with about race to the top, and that Michigan didn't get in the first round choices of finalists, which means we won't have a chance for the first round winning. Although, as you mentioned, there's a second. A second chance, sort of, second round. So we'll see what happens with that. But you think it's because the Detroit public schools, which had such problems, but they're actually under reorganization from Robert Bob, and that it's kind of in flux. That, do you think that was a negative? I mean, we can only guess, but I mean, that's got to be a good thing in a way, is that Michigan and Detroit, was forced on Detroit, is in this reorganization mode, but we don't know the outcome exactly yet. It's still a couple of years forming here.
Yeah, I know that Secretary Duncan is well aware of what's going on in Detroit. He has visited there a couple of times. He knows the work that Robert Bob is doing there. As far as if the current conflict between Robert Bob and the current board is having made a difference, I don't know that. I hope not. I hope that they were looking at each application from a statewide perspective and not just on one school district in the state. So I certainly hope that did not play a role or a factor in this, but I don't know. I mean, that's a question best left to Secretary Duncan.
Yeah, and I guess we'll see when the results come out.
Right.
Well, Martin Ackley, Director of Communications for the Office of Superintendent Mike Flanagan, thank you for being with us on today's the new WHFR Journal.
Well, thank you for calling me and for thinking about the Michigan Department of Education and our need to improve our schools here in Michigan.
We'll stay in touch with you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. We're going to take a little break on the WHFR Journal here. We're going to listen to our national commentator, Jim Hightower. He's got an opinion about buying America. And also, certainly in Detroit, we want to hear his opinion about Toyota. Also, Toyota's friends, in fact. Yes, they have some significant ones. This is WHFR, the new WHFR Journal. And we're making waves. Come on back for more local news and alternative views.
Who owns America? Wall Street, you say? The corporate powers? Well, yes. But who owns them? The carefully contrived myth is that they are owned by you and me, The millions of mom-and-pop investors, pension fund retirees, and people with savings in mutual funds. This Norman Rockwell portrait of widespread financial democracy is heartwarming, but a lie. Controlling ownership is securely in the hands of financial elites. Indeed, buckle up for a xenophobic jolt. Increasingly, America is owned by super-wealthy foreign interests. Take a peek, for example, at a sovereign wealth fund known as CIC, the China Investment Corporation. This $300 billion pile of money has become the Chinese government's chief tool for spreading its global ownership, including stakes in dozens of major U.S. companies. Since it was created in 2007, CIC has invested more than $9 billion in such iconic American brands as Aetna, Apple, Bank of America, Coca-Cola, Eli Lilly, Goodyear, Johnson & Johnson, MetLife, Visa, and Wells Fargo. Most of CIC's stock purchases are not huge, but its ownership can be expected to expand steadily, for CIC is funded from China's almost bottomless stash of foreign cash. Ironically, much of the $2.4 trillion it holds in foreign reserves comes from us, American consumers, businesses, and even governments that keep buying products imported from China. So CIC is using our exported dollars to buy our domestic corporations and banks. For example, last year Morgan Stanley repaid its bailout money to us taxpayers, but nearly $2 billion of the payback came from selling a chunk of itself to CIC. This is Jim Hightower saying, China says it's merely a passive investor with no political agenda. For now. Poor Toyota. Because of an explosion of deadly safety glitches in its cars, the Japanese auto giant is getting pounded by the media, scorched by public opinion, sued by its customers, investigated by numerous regulators, and grilled by congressional committees. Right about now, the beleaguered multi-billion-dollar corporation is probably wishing it had some friends in high places. But wait, it does. In fact, Toyota has many well-placed friends in Washington. Start with lobbyists. Over the years, Toyota has steadily built up a stout lobbying force in our capital city, far surpassing the presence of other foreign automakers. Last year, it had 31 of these influence peddlers on its payroll, including 8 former congressional and agency staffers. Also, former officials and engineers from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration have switched hats and are now in the employ of Toyota. Yes, NHTSA is the outfit that was supposed to be regulating the car maker to protect the driving public from exactly the kind of safety defects that have led to hundreds of Toyota crashes and the recall of some 8 million cars. Then there are the various lawmakers who have substantial financial connections to the manufacturer, including 2 House members who are on the committees presently probing Toyota. California Democrat Jane Harman holds Toyota stock worth up to $315,000. Across the aisle, California Republican Daryl Issa got rich making auto alarms that his company sold to, guess who, Toyota, as well as other car makers. This is Jim Hightower saying, Toyota can't expect to get a free pass because it has these friends in high places, but it has already enjoyed years of kid-glove regulatory treatment, and its lobbyists are now pushing for the gentlest of punishments for this reckless corporate scoundrel.
Dearborn Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr. will deliver his annual State of the City Address on Wednesday, March 10th at 7 p.m. at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center. Please join us, 89.3 WHFR.FM, as we broadcast live Mayor O'Reilly's review of Dearborn's major accomplishments in 2009 and his initiatives that will move Dearborn forward in 2010 and beyond. WHFR.FM, we're making waves.
This is the new WHFR Journal. Jay, Dennis, and Amy are here for your education and entertainment today. More Dennis for entertainment than the rest of us. But so, Dennis,
wow.
What's the big news about the race for governor? New announcements?
My understanding is that Andy Dillon has thrown his name in the hat. Wow.
Yeah. So whose hat is that?
Whose hat is the governor's hat?
Just kidding.
Oh.
Into the governor's race. It's a metaphor, folks. Okay.
And what's a metaphor? No, I wanted to announce that because he was so kind as to come on our show, a couple months ago. We spoke with him.
Right, and talked about the J-20 funding and
Well, mainly that.
Yes.
And
which is part of the funding for public schools in Michigan and specifically an important component for Dearborn Public Schools,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Well, we're not endorsing Andy Dillon here. We're glad he's in the race for governor. Gives us another choice, another person to look at in the story, in the paper.
And we expect that he'll be back on, along with all other candidates vying for...
You mean they're back on our station?
Yes,
well,
back on our station.
If they want to win, yeah. Look at the bump.
Okay. Yeah, the journal bump, as we call it.
Well, some people say that's just myth, but I believe it. Well, that it's myth. Sorry.
You could say that we got one of the new council candidates here in Dearborn on there, but
right.
There's no evidence it was us.
We got one. Right.
But at least we interviewed him, by golly, and so it couldn't hurt, could it? No,
nope.
It didn't hurt, and apparently. Okay. There is a great article on school funding, but we're going to look at Representative Dillon running for governor here first of all. And it's always interesting, even if you're reading the paper, most people stop when the story stops on that page and they don't follow up later because they think, oh, it's just little details that nobody needs to know. In fact, folks, this story and the next one we're going to do about West Dearborn development, it's pretty surprising what is right at the end, okay? And here's the ending of the story about Dillon's announcement. And again, we're glad he's in the race. He's got some interesting ideas worthy of discussion, certainly. Some Democrats, however, and this is in the story in the Dearborn Press and Guide this way, fault Dillon for going along with a Senate Republican plan to cut $1.2 billion in spending in the current budget with the hope that some of the money would be restored. Bishop, that's Senate Majority Leader, Republican Mike Bishop, refused to go along with any of the House plans for more revenue after the budget was passed. So Dillon didn't support the Democratic Party position there. Also, Dillon is a Catholic who opposes abortion and embryonic stem cell research. Of course, it's his right to be any religion he wants to, but he does take the Catholic Church position on those issues. And those are stances that might help him with some Republican voters who also are opposing abortion and stem cell research. But it could put him at odds with the Democratic base. There is going to be a primary, of course, vote of all the Democratic candidates August the 3rd here in Michigan. But then it's going to go back to the conventions, the party conventions. And I heard something, I may be wrong on this, but the choice of the people for the Democratic candidate for governor may not be what the party endorses. Certainly, the party goes on to endorse the running mate, okay, the lieutenant governor, and the attorney general, and so on and so forth. For example, Governor Engler, Republican, many years ago, when he ran, he wanted a certain person to be his attorney general. The Republican Party said, no, we want this other person. Well, the other person had turned out to be such a weak candidate that got Jennifer Granholm elected as a Democrat. So they blame the Republican Party convention for picking a party faithful person, but not somebody who had a good chance of getting elected. So they went against Engler's recommendation, even though he was the candidate for governor. So those party conventions are still important. I think the public does get their way on the governor candidate. I don't think conventions can override that. But I want to look into that a little more. There was a study on Michigan, a story on Michigan Public Radio last week. The Michigan Public Radio, and this is WUOM in Ann Arbor, okay, and two other cities in the U.S. up in Flint, they have such a station, which is all programmed the same in these, and it's National Public Radio affiliates, but they all sort of work together on that. And they have a Lansing Weekly Report, only 3 minutes long. I wish we could run it for you, folks. I asked them. I talked to them. WDET doesn't run it, to my knowledge, okay, from Lansing. And that report was an interview with our friendly curmudgeon from the Metro Times, Jack Lesenberry. He's their analyst. Believe it or not, Michigan Public Radio has Jack Lesenberry as an analyst. And he can be fair and balanced. if you force him. And he was there talking to a Cynthia, someone or other from Michigan Public. So they were suggesting about how important these party conventions are for the Dems and Republicans after the primary in terms of who finally gets on the ballot. So we're going to look at that a little more and find out what's going on there. Also hear about Dylan. He's been courting business leaders. In fact, I heard in another source that he is the most businessman-friendly candidate the Dems have so far.
Well, I think they need to have a business-friendly in order to compete with the Republican Party. And I think since there's such a wave of animosity toward the current administration, he's trying to set himself apart.
Right. The Republicans seem to always have a businessman type like DeVos and maybe Rick Snyder in the future, successful entrepreneurs up as their candidates. And Michigan is known for middle-of-the-road voting on, that is, centrist voting for governor. For many years we had Engler as governor, even though Dems everywhere else. And Governor Milliken many years back, a very moderate, that is, centrist Republican, not a conservative Republican at all, in fact, and Michigan loved him. Governor Romney, not Milt Romney, that it's the son of George Romney, who was governor here in Michigan for many years. He was a very moderate, you might even say liberal Republican, and state of Michigan elected him for more than one term until he announced he had been brainwashed in Vietnam. That's a long story. No insult to the Romneys. He was misunderstood.
Or the Manchurian candidate.
Right. That's what it sounded then, because yes. That was a 1964 movie with Frank Sinatra, I believe, who was the one. The British guy.
His name will come to me.
Okay.
Well, I'm trying to. Now you're going to drive me nuts.
The one who was brainwashed, yeah. Okay.
Yes.
But there was a book, too, Manchurian Kennedy.
And they remade the movie
Murder,
later.
And Murder, She Wrote, that woman, Angela Lansbury, was the mother.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And the very,
Well, it was just unfortunate because George Romney really was very smart, and he was complaining about Vietnam being the leaders there whitewashing the actual fact of the war, which is we were losing, and not giving accurate feedback to Congress and the American public about what the situation really was. And that's another story for another time. If you haven't already heard it, I'll look it up. Dylan, who's in his final and third term in the House, is married with four children. Well, that's always good to know. Why doesn't he stay at home and help the kids? But
help his wife.
I guess his wife, yeah.
He's governor, maybe.
I always think, we should elect him because he's got all these kids, but then he can't be with the kids, But he's term limited, just like Granholm, just like Gino Polidori. Right. Can't run again. And maybe we want him to run again. I mean, he's had a pretty good career. I mean, was the head of all the Dems in the House. Guess he knows how to do it now after four terms, three terms, six years. Too bad, even if he wanted to run again, even if he should run again, he can't.
And I do think that he's one of the few that has the ability to reach across party lines, to use that phrase. So that
he's had his moments with Bishop fisticuffs but he's had his moments and rightly so. There is something I want to recommend to our listeners. I usually mention them, but we don't have time to go into depth and read them, because that's what reading is for, folks, to go in depth and really think about it. There is the usual tete-a-tete debate, if you will, between a Democratic Party representative locally and a Republican Party representative locally. And it's in last Sunday's Dearborn Press and Guide. Maybe you can find it online at pressandguide.com. Morris Goodman versus John Connolly. Goodman, the Democrat locally, and John Connolly, not related to the man that got shot with Kennedy in Texas back in the... Anyway, John Connolly locally, Republican. And the issue this week is how to stop partisan bickering. Well, I read the articles, and basically the Dems say it's all the Republicans' fault, and the Republican guy, he says it's all the Dems' fault. We're not the party of no. They're the party of no. We're the party of
but
yes.
But you saw
no,
that coming, didn't you?
And they're both right.
Absolutely.
So they're, so you know, the topic is really closer to what about that partisan bickering, and I wrote down how to stop it. They didn't talk about how to stop it. They just said it's all the fault of the other guy. So it's a good example, folks, of partisan bickering here. And how do you stop it? We don't have enough time in the show or enough intelligent political scientists.
Just take credit for it. It'll stop right there, right?
Yeah, we'll just get more people elected on your party and just reconcile all those bills.
That's bullying.
Okay, Paul Krugman, if I may do this, we have 12 minutes left in the hour. Highway 61 Blues coming up at 2 o'clock today, of course. But in today's New York Times, Paul Krugman, who is the award-winning, Nobel Prize-winning economist, an observer of all things economic and political that affect economies, has an editorial here, and it's not just about Senator Jim Bunning. And some people who are as old as I am remember Jim Bunning was a famous pitcher with the Detroit Tigers in his early career before he moved to Kentucky. I think he was with another team in Kentucky, and then he decided to go into politics in Kentucky. He was known as a sort of cantankerous, angry pitcher, too, that wasn't always friendly to even fans here in Detroit, I remember. But, of course, he was in all the media. You saw this day after day this week. He kept objecting to an extension, just for 1 month, of welfare funding, which would affect an awful lot of people over the whole country. And just a one-month extension, all on general principles, we don't have the money. Well, we don't have the money for anything. We've been in debt for years as a country. So you might as well not approve anything. In fact, you shouldn't approve the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. Why? We don't have the money. Okay. How did they approve money for anything? If you use Bunning's argument, you don't fund anything. Government's out of business, and we're all scavenging for food in the what's remaining of our forest or something. I mean, it's just ludicrous, but I know he's a man of principle and all that, and so I'll give him that. All right. Well, here's what Paul Krugman said. It's not really just about Bunning. He says, so the Bunning blockade is over. For days, Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky exploited Senate rules to block a one-month extension of unemployed benefits. In the end, he gave in, although not soon enough to prevent an interruption of payments to around 100,000 workers. I think it was 2 or 3 days, actually, that didn't get any funding there. But while the blockade is over, Krugman goes on to say its lessons remain. What I want to focus on right now is the incredible gap that has opened up between the parties. Today, Democrats and Republicans, this is a spinoff, therefore, from the debate here in Dearborn and the Press and Guy between Goodman and Connolly. He says, what I want to focus is this opening, what has opened up, the gap between Dems and Republicans. He says, Dems and Republicans live in different universes, both intellectually and morally. He says, take the question of helping the unemployed in the middle of a deep slump. What Democrats believe is what textbook economists say, and that is when the economy is deeply depressed, extending unemployment benefits not only helps those in need, it also reduces unemployment. So all professors who study and research know that that is true. You do spend your way of a depression. You do. It does work. And there are a few that say it doesn't. Like, you know, everything in the 1930s that FDR did. Oh, no, he shouldn't have done that. It made it worse. It extended the depression longer. Well, that's a very, very minority opinion. Okay, very minority. The massive position of the vast majority, I'd guess 90% of all economists at all levels, people who study these things, know that you spend money to get out of a depression from the federal government level to create jobs, even if they're make-work jobs like the Civilian Conservation Corps. Anybody remember the CCC back in the 30s? Those are make-work jobs. They did help. They kept people from starving. They kept money flowing into families until another job could happen. And when they weren't needed, they faded away. Okay. Anyway, back to the story, back to the Krugman's opinion here. So, folks, there's no doubt that Bunning was on the wrong side about that, because economists, all of them, not just liberal economists, but really all, including Republican economists, vast majority Republican economists, if you can be an economist and also be a party faithful. It's not like a religion, is it? Or should it be? In any event, they say you got to put the money out there. In fact, Krugman was one of the economists that said, we didn't spend enough money on unemployment and finding jobs for people. That's why things are still kind of sluggish. He wanted much more money, but that wasn't approved, of course. He says, now, because the economy's problem right now is lack of a sufficient demand and cash-strapped unemployment workers are likely to spend their benefits. So that's the situation of the advantage of getting the money to flow. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office, also known as CBO, says that aid to the unemployed is one of the most effective forms of economic stimulus as measured by jobs created per dollar of outlay. But that's not how Republicans see it, according to Paul Krugman. Here's what Senator John Kyle, that's K-Y-L, of Arizona, had to say when defending Bunning's position, although not joining his blockade. Unemployment relief doesn't create new jobs. In fact, if anything, continuing to pay people unemployment compensation is a disincentive for them to seek new work, unquote from Senator Kyle of Arizona. In Kyle's view, what we really need to worry about right now, with more than 5 unemployed workers for every job opening and long-term unemployment at its highest level since the Great Depression, is whether we're reducing the incentive of the unemployed to find jobs. To me, says Paul Krugman, that's a bizarre point of view, but then I don't live in Kyle's universe. Bill Clinton famously told a suffering constituent, "I feel your pain." But the thing is, he did and does, while many other politicians clearly don't. Or it might be fair to say that the parties feel the pain of different people. And I wanted to go from that opinion, from Nobel Prize-winning columnist and economist Paul Krugman, just to an article I got today in... Of course, I can't find it now, so now I'm stuck.
But what's it relating to?
There it is. Arizona, Senator Kyle. In Arizona, the people of Arizona, just so you know, just by counterpoint, I know we're in Michigan and so on, kept their upper lips stiff when officials mortgaged off the state's executive office tower and a Daily Show crew, Jon Stewart's show, of course, on Comedy Central, rolled into town to chronicle the transaction in mocking tone. So their whole executive office tower of the state was mortgaged off. They sold the building. They remained calm, apparently, in Arizona as lawmakers pondered privatizing death row. Let's get a private company to kill our prisoners for us. Okay, they get better knowledge of electricity or drugs or something. Anyway, and the article goes on in the New York Times, but then the state took away their toilets. And residents began to revolt. And this is toilets where? Along the highways, the interstate highways, right, in Arizona. Apparently, there's only one rest stop between Phoenix and Tucson now, which is a two-hour drive. And they decided, the Department of Transportation, by the way, Arizona has the largest budget gap in the country when measured as a percentage of its overall budget. So they're in deep budget problems. But so they said that the State Department of Transportation was $100 million in red, and it decided to close 13 of the state's 18 highway rest stops. But the move has unleashed a torrent of telephone calls and email messages to state lawmakers, newspapers, and the Department of Transportation deploring the lost toilets. One of the scores of small indignities among larger hardships that residents of embattled states such as Arizona here face as governments scramble to shore up their finances. So I wonder if we're going to lose our toilets.
I don't know, but that's a motivator.
In Michigan.
Well, it really should be. Biggest problem?
It should be a health care thing people get upset about. It should be an education funding thing that they get. But here in Arizona, after everything else is taken away from them, apparently, it's their toilets on their interstate highways. Don't they have those infamous diapers for adults?
Well, that depends.
They sell. Yeah. They sell that at the one rest stop.
Yes. And on the same page, the New York Times this morning, Friday, March 5th, tuition protest. Angered by increases in tuition and cuts in state funding, thousands of students, parents, and faculty protested across California on Thursday. And we know what. They're bankrupt in California on Thursday, demonstrating at colleges, universities, and even elementary schools to plead for help on the state's ongoing crisis. There were scattered tuition protests in other states, too, with at least 16 people detained in Wisconsin when students threw ice chunks. They still have ice in Wisconsin outside the office of the school chancellor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. That's according to university officials. So ice chunks. I guess they don't have any snowballs left. Okay, back to some local things to finish up our show. Got 4 minutes left here on the Journal.
Well, we were talking about some of the things that are being taken away. We have something here right in the area in Wayne County that we have an opportunity. There's a program that's helped nearly 2,000 residents across Wayne County avoid or survive mortgage foreclosure. Mm-hmm. And this is a program, the Wayne County Mortgage Foreclosure Prevention Program. And basically what they do is they renegotiate the terms of the mortgage, make it more affordable for the homeowner. And in the case, there's their counselors also. And in the case of losing the home, they give them alternatives and they help them survive it. And I just wanted people to know if they're in this particular situation, you can enter it's called the MFPP program, which is the Mortgage Foreclosure Prevention Program. You can visit fightmortgageforeclosure.com. fightmortgageforeclosure.com or contact the program directly at 877-693-8255. 877-693-6199. That's 877-693-6199, and they have people to help you.
Great, Dennis. Here's an important thing that we can leave you with, and that is an event here 2 weeks from today that we hope you find the time, 8:30 in the morning to 4 p.m. in the afternoon, to attend.
That's the third annual Alternative Energy Summit right here on the campus of Henry Ford College. It's in the Mazara Administration Services and Conference Center. The summit is free. It's open to the public, and it's co-sponsored by HFCC's Student Environmental Association and our Alternative Energy Program. So keynote speakers are going to be Peter Sinclair of the Green Man Studio.
Saw him last year. Very informative, amazing ideas, cutting-edge stuff that nobody's really heard in the media yet about how to save energy and new directions for the future and how to keep Michigan growing with new kinds of green jobs.
And also radio broadcast journalist Matt Rausch, who'll discuss renewable, I would imagine, energy in Michigan, and Beth Summers of the Michigan Department of Energy, Labor, and Economic Growth, who will talk about green jobs in Michigan, which Henry Ford has a certificate program in green jobs.
Extremely popular. Extremely.
Yeah.
You know, the summit, Mr. Bill Sechrest is a professor here, and we're going to have him on the Campus Connection on Tuesday.
Perfect.
So everybody know, between 1 and 2 o'clock.
Last year at the summit, which I attended, in fact, we had some clips from Peter Sinclair that I was able to get on my recorder and play during the show, and maybe there'll even be someone from this event we can get here in the journal if they have free time between 1 and 2 to give part of the flavor to you. This is so exciting. There's green vendors that sort of like a small expo set up in our Mazara conference building. It's just south of our student center building right here on the Henry Ford Community College main campus, Evergreen Road. Again, this event is free to attend, and sessions every hour or so from 8:30 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon from really good, bright people coming in from Washington, D.C., I guess, Department of Energy and Lansing and other places. And you might say, well, don't you have any HFCC professors? Well, they'll be around, but, I mean, it's a high-power thing. It's not just our teachers talking. I think there will probably be a table explaining our degree program if you want some brochures on that.
It better be, right?
Absolutely, because we got a great program in alternative energy, both a one-year certificate, which is kind of informational, and a two-year program that could tie up to a four-year degree too. But it was so exciting. They even had free rides. Ford Motor Company was contacted, and I don't know if it's going to happen this year, and they had a bunch of hybrids that people were allowed to take out on the road, including Dr. Gail Mee, who has a Ford Escape hybrid as her own personal car, and has had, this is her second one, in fact, that she's had, probably leased it, but nonetheless, she was letting people drive her personal car even.
Really?
Talk about user-friendly around here.
Yeah.
Just to get an idea that hybrids are real cars and you can really buy them. They cost a little more, and maybe it's a good thing to do. You know, the economic trade-off in terms of the gas that you buy and the extra insurance on the higher priced car, and there's still a few rebates from the government on certain models, but like the Prius doesn't have a rebate anymore because they sold too many, and that was the federal government stopped rebates after the cars get a firm foothold, let's say, in the marketplace. There was so much going on. I was so excited. I'm definitely going to be there myself, wandering around and just listening and getting information. And we'll share as much as we can that Friday, or maybe we'll have a follow-up and some of our soundbite clips for